Varanasi, garrulous city swathed in fog, dusty streets teeming with saffron sadhus smoking hashish, sun-dried women carrying babies and bundles and the weight of age and memory and beauty and rot, barefoot children, their threadbare clothes, windows on their whittled bodies, selling postcards of the ghats and temples to privileged insulated tourists, and a virtual menagerie composed of pugnacious monkeys, lumbering cows, immovable buffaloes, scatterbrained chickens, and countless chirping birds carving arcs in the air. City whose filigree temples are flanked by shacks and rubbish heaps. Grunting city that mocks my practiced sincerity. City whose talons grip the nape of my neck. Recombinant city entered through a multiplicity of openings, doors, windows, gateways, dreams. Recursive city, it mumbles, breath to death. It mumbles, birth to earth. Sepulchral city, it rasps, dust in the shadows, dust in the wall cracks, dust in the air, dust on the windows, dust in the whitewashed sky. It was Sunday. In 4 days, the name Lashkar-e-Kahar would sound and eddy out and cleave an abyss between before and after, yield blackened cries and inmost sobs. Having ridden a rickety rickshaw through the train station at Mughal Sarai with a driver snake-charming serpentine streets, imperiously passing other auto rickshaws, pedal cabs, unhelmeted motorcyclists, and pedestrians slaloming around, and negotiating the opposing traffic full of their lookalikes, the air punctuated with crisp carolines, accusatory honks, and my own rickshaw's apartment buzzer chirp, and its fluttering engine, brrrr, I was anxious to set my belongings down, and though I had more weight than I could handle, belongings were not what I wanted unloaded from my body. Nor was it my sense of belonging, since I had long since lost that in my bright-eyed and hammered years. Nevertheless, it was with this buckled knees feeling that I immediately searched for a guest house, rather than follow my original plan to become invisible, that is, to lose myself in the city, for I had set out to get away from the nagging of this follows that, to escape this fumbling for a foothold feeling. But instead, what replaced, no, predominated over that like river sediment cementing over a plain, was this feeling that I was an outline. The borders of whatever it was I was, widening out, losing form, and peering through a palimpsest of memories I was not sure were even my own anymore. Not mine, because if it is true that we are irrevocably altered by whatever or whoever touches us, then as a result, those experiences we thought were our own must belong to someone else. I wondered, who was this person transformed? Yes, but still composed of these layers of memory. Did this mean that the only appropriate end for a life lived in perpetual blankness was an unmarked grave? Walking up the cracked steps and through the door of what would be my home for the coming days, a sleepy sandalwood scent in the air, I scanned the paint-chapped walls, cracked floor tiles, and the worn furniture's stringy upholstery, and an eager clerk who smiled, splattered me with pleasantries, softened me with sirs, and beckoned a boy to help me with my bags. And lazing on the counter before the clerk, a cat, framed by a wedge of light, knowingly eyed me, sussed me out as the Luftmensch that I was, an impractical amalgam of flesh and air, contemplative, and useless, a drifter living off the remains of his already meager savings. Glowing behind the clerk was a large, largely unreflective mirror that still made the room seem larger. The man, splaying open a thick mildewed book, a chained pen flopping out like a fish out of water, asked how long I was planning to stay with them, fingered a line for me to sign in time with the airy music he had playing from a box. "Until the day I leave," I said. And from his smile, I gathered that he understood what I meant. I asked him what we were listening to. "Sumun, Bukman, Umyun, do you know Farrell Sanders?" he said. He was asking if I was aware of him, of his music, but I said, "Yes, we are old friends." I was doing this a lot, interpreting questions to mean something different than what they were intended to mean. "You like jazz," I said. "It was a small world after all," he said and laughed. His laughter wet through as if it had been bathed in something clear. I did not correct his misremembering of the phrase. I asked him what it meant. "Music means whatever you want it to mean, sir," he said. I try to mirror his inscrutable, beatific smile. Oh, it means deaf, dumb, blind, sir. My life in 3Ds, I said, rapping my knuckles on the counter. There were funnier responses, of course, but I had been tired of the game long before we had begun. He laughed again. Sometimes we put it on infinite repeat, he said. That and the next song. Let us go into the house of the Lord. I liked what he said about the music, about putting it on infinite repeat. I took it to mean something more than the programmed repetition he was talking about. I was doing this a lot, too, investing more meaning into what people said, into what happened around and to me. He told me he had once worked in a hotel where the managers had played jazz to attract Westerners. And he laughed, recalling how customers would complain, how they had wanted to hear Indian music, even filmy, those odd, ebullient soundtracks, which he could never bear to listen to. But jazz had taken hold of him, he said. He told me more about jazz and the names flew by. After more prodding from him, I shared that I was here to walk along the shores of the Ganges. He told me that John Coltrane's wife, Alice, a devotee of Satya Sai Baba, an Indian guru, had sprinkled the saxophonist's ashes into the holy river. I had nothing to say, and so I just listened, followed the rise and fall of his words more than the actual meaning. Seeing me zone away, the clerk apologized and pointed to the stairs where the boy waited for me. As I followed him toward my room, the cat, a sandy-colored thing, pounced to the floor and before slinking into a shadowy corridor, slowly swiveled its head and blinked at me. From my room's balcony, ginger-smeared by the sun, I eyed the locals like a god. How my mind was still stuck in a mundane monotheism amidst its India's poly-everything was a mystery to me, gazing upon his witless creation, so unlike chess, where the figurines with their unchanging features, roles, and gestures performed precisely on a Euclidean battlefield, and the narrow, winding streets, streets as labyrinthal as consciousness, as full of uncertainty as they were of wonder and just as filthy. Wild-style geometries, riverbank stairs on top of stairs, overlapping stairs, colliding into stairs, leading up to temples and palaces and guest houses. 5 bare-chested men sat cross-legged facing the river. A fleet of old boats floated at the ramparts, long bamboo steering poles jutting out from them like locusts' antennae. A group of boys wrestled each other into the water. A whimsically mustachioed man spoke into a rockabilly-type microphone, glancing intermittently at a tome on his lap. 2 men carried an enwrapped and garlanded body atop a makeshift bamboo stretcher and rested it on 4 blocks of ice. A tatterdemalion of a man, a Hadijan, one of Gandhi's so-called children of God, tended the flame of a pyre. I watched a torso bubble and drip and blacken, and then husks of it fall away, exposing a ribcage the fire too slowly consumed. But the spine, while charred black, remained intact, irresolute, as if still fulfilling its duty to prop somebody up, and a river-facing skull, flesh, even now around its mouth, seemed about to laugh, its teeth then spilling out of its maw, before the lighter of the pyre crushed its dome with a bamboo pole, finally freeing its soul, releasing it from the circle of birth and death. Nearby, an oblivious emaciated goat munched on a garland of marigolds. Eyes sweeping back to the Ganges, I saw 2 men on a boat weigh down the body of a leper with stones and then heave it into the river, the sound of it from where I was, perfunctory, curt. But I could not possibly know all this. Things were escaping from me now, much like air from a tired and deflating windbag. Later, after a plate of koftas, balls of minced beef that effervesced in my stomach, and an assortment of fried and baked breads, all washed down with a mango lassi, I sat at a table thinking about how I was thinking, and I thought about how hard it was to move, how I was trapped in one of Zeno's paradoxical ideas, trapped into thinking about the impossibility of motion. I had to get halfway there before I could get the whole way. But before that, I would have to get a quarter of the way before I could get halfway, and, well, then I was trapped in an infinite regress. There could be no first step. If I cannot start it, how then can I ever complete it? This thinking paradoxically propelled my body. My energy, no, my will unraveling like one of those balsa wood wind-up rubber band-powered airplanes set aloft. and emptied my head in order to sail straight over the other heads bobbing around me and toward something else, something higher, something less concrete, but somehow more real, something like air maybe, something that waited for me, no, something that followed me, ran away from me and waited for me, something that was both a shadow and whatever was its opposite. Do the shadows we cast even have an opposite? Something impossible like that. Instead, I was sucked through litter-strewn streets like the lumpy bolus searing through my intestines, through an alleyway of arches where a gallery of bird cages hung from walls, where translucent canopies billowed like sails, through another alley where piles of potatoes, brainy cauliflowers, unraveling cabbages, nosy carrots, phallic cucumbers, woody bulbous turnips, gold papery onions, Christmassy red and green chilies, itsy-bitsy pebbly peas and beans, chunks of okra, bitter bottle, pointed and ridge gourds, globular radishes, lugubrious pumpkins, and cairns of tomatoes all sat on winsome wicker bowls. Streams of people, sometimes sidling against me and matching my stride, sometimes allowing me to move ahead, and then running to catch up with me in a kind of peripatetic polyrhythm, plied me with promises of marble-floored former palaces, air-conditioned guest houses with the best view of the Holy River, enticed me with doughy dumplings soaked in rosy syrup, frozen custards and fried funnel-cake-like confections dusted with cloves, cardamom and saffron, and warm puddings loaded with nuts and dried apples, mangoes, bananas, guava, papaya, or pineapples, beguiled me with intimations of relaxing massages, with the mention of ganja, a sure physic for stress, anime, and angst, or simply solicited me for rupees. And so I felt as if I had metamorphosed into a living automatic teller machine. It did not help that I still wore a cuffed, button-down, long-sleeved shirt and dark slacks, albeit both very much rumpled, and lace-up oxfords, the stitched details across the rounded toes lost beneath 3 weeks' worth of caked-on dirt. Though certainly less than charitable, I was just about ready to give up everything. I had come to know Varanasi as I had come to know what I knew, which was little, about India. Well, no, not even as little as the tittle of its eye, first through my feet and then through my eyes and ears. And what I had learned was that Varanasi was a concatenation of contradictions, and that instead of sorting them out or reconciling them somehow, I should simply revel within this old city's darkness and light, its chaos and stillness, its abundance and scarcity, its silence and noise. But nothing could prepare me for the Ghats. Decrepit and funereal, there was still a kind of magic to them. But no, saying it was magical was, well, how can magic be possible in a disenchanted world? Call it strange and beautiful then, an atmosphere where everything, every measure of intimacy was performed center stage, people bathing, laundering, eating, brushing their teeth, sometimes using just a finger, shaving, sleeping, and praying, and pissing and shitting, everything but sex. And vendors hawking food, saris, incense, and trinkets, and cows, goats, and dogs roaming around everywhere. Ritual ablutions in a dirty river, it was total immersion here. Flowers and food and bottles of water, juice and teas and statues from the Hindu pantheon and religious books and shirts and pots and pans and cutlery. If this city were holy, it was because of its seeming unconcern with appearances, its flagrant disregard for order. It was dusk when I came to the Harish Chandra Ghat, where I dipped my hands at the river's edge and watched little flowery candle floats drifting languidly, caracals, budrows, and canoes floating slowly by, cumbrous barges bobbing, everything wreathed by a chalky mist. A man, his eyes bloodshot from the crematory smoke, crept toward me, stuck his beak-like nose in my face, and pecked at me with scattered thoughts, flooded me with information in an attempt to coax me into paying him for a tour. There is burning, everybody learning, good karma, bad karma, life very short, look like dust, soul is going, so no ghost, body sink, sometime body come up, dog and eagle eat. From his incessant talk, I also pieced together that after a father dies, the family's eldest son shaves his head, wears white, and lights the funeral pyre. But the youngest son lights the mother's pyre. After the body has been burning for 2 hours, a bone is selected from it and then tossed into the Ganges, the men a chest bone, the women a hip bone. After a short while, I gave the man some rupees and waved him away. I wanted to stand there without a soundtrack playing in my ear. Watching the fire, I felt something like nostalgia, like this was all strangely familiar. It felt like sitting around a campfire, its bright glow and smoke inspiring secret sharing and inducing sleep. Think of me as a pilgrim, why not? But not one tinkling bells, lighting candles or incense, clapping hands to wake up a god, not a seeker of relics of transcendence, of release from earthly indignities, but as one contemplating the calamity of his life, one regarding ancient ruins as mirrors of his own rubble, or instead, as a man with an unclean spirit, like one of those biblical unfortunates wandering around vacant spaces, seeking solace and never finding it, an extinguished man, or perhaps as a man in pain, seeking a cure for an illness he knows there is no cure for, because what can cure nothing when something, no, countless somethings, were the cause of that nothing? I'll stop there. Thanks.